Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio's continuing efforts, not broadcast live from CFUV Radio in the basement of the Student Union Building at the University of Victoria, but recorded in our home-based studios on this date, October 5th, 2020. Well, on today's program, a remembrance of a long-time guest of Guerrilla Radio and even longer champion of all this program professes, and much more too, itinerant globe-trotting journalist Andre Velcek died in September on the first day of autumn, fittingly, while still in motion, careening through an exotic city on the far side of the world. But then, for Andre, the world had no sides. He lived on the whole of it. It's difficult to imagine another like him in this time or any other. He lived and worked among the most wretched, ever faithful to the interests of those oppressed by state and corporate power. He did this constantly, it seemed. One could never be sure where he'd be at a given moment, but what was certain, he wouldn't be there for long. Today, I'll play clips from some of the many interviews we conducted together over the last 12 years. I first interviewed Andre in 2008, introducing him thus. Andre Velcek is a freelance journalist, author, and filmmaker specializing in the Pacific region. He's a senior fellow at the Oakland Institute, co-founder of Mainstay Press, a publishing house for progressive political fiction, and serves as editorial director for the Asiana Press Agency. Some of Andre Velcek's book titles include Western Terror, From Potosi to Baghdad, Exile, and his latest, Point of No Return. He also produced Terlina, Breaking of a Nation, a documentary chronicling the life and legacy of Indonesian dictator Suharto. In that first interview, both distant and still topically relevant today, I contacted Andre in Samoa, where he was working on his book on U.S. and Western involvement in Pacific Island nations. And we began by talking about Indonesia and the death of its recently resigned dictator Suharto. Here then is Andre Velcek from 2008. Welcome to the program, Andre.
Thank you, Chris.
Now, can you tell me the correct pronunciation of your surname?
It's Andre Velcek.
Velcek. Well, thank you for coming on, Andre. Now, sadly, we have less time than I had planned for because this is such an expensive call because you're in Samoa.
Well, I'm actually writing a book about Pacific Island nations, and I'm based in Samoa because it's, believe it or not, it's one of the most convenient places to travel from, although... it has only one flight a day, usually. There are some places where you have to wait for the flight for 2 days, sometimes for 1 week. So I'm writing the book, which will be hopefully published by one of the publishing houses at Cornell University. I'm working with Mark Selden, who is my editor. And it's going to be a book about U.S. involvement, and not only U.S., but also Australia and New Zealand involvement in this part of the world.
Well, of course, Indonesia, for those that know, is renowned as one of the most brutal regimes in the world, and it's held that title for decades now, but we hear, as I said in the intro, we hardly ever hear anything about it. Is the situation in Indonesia improved any since the death of Suharto earlier this year?
Not really. Actually, what happened is that after Suharto stepped down, before he died, of course, after he stepped down, there was... Indonesians launched something what they called Reformasi, which was reformation. It was not really a revolution. There was no dramatic change. And elites that were ruling Indonesia during Suharto and the military, they all stayed in power. So there is not much difference except that you can speak out now. You can actually form NGOs. You can publish your articles online. You can criticize the government on the street. But in reality, in terms of the power structure and in terms of the economic structure, nothing changed. Also, the military, which was responsible for 1965 massacres in which between 2 and 3 million people died, the same military which massacred about one-third of the population of East Timor, that very same military is now still in power. So you have the situation when the former army general SBY, Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono, is now a president of the country. His wife is actually a daughter of Red Beret general who was responsible for most of the killings, or for many killings in 1965-1966. So the situation is such that the mainstream media in the West is portraying Indonesia as a as a country which is striving for democracy and the only Muslim country which can prove that democracy and Islam can go together. But in reality, it is still the same dictatorship, only with much better PR.
Well, yeah, and the fact that they've managed to stay under the radar in so much as the Western press is concerned, it's quite an accomplishment when you outline, as you do, these horrendous crimes committed by this regime. Most famously, I suppose, Amy Goodman was in Timor when the main killing began, and she herself was nearly killed. But other than Democracy Now, you rarely hear anything at all about Indonesia or what they're doing. What hope is there for reforms in that country right now, Andre?
Well, the greatest Indonesian writer, Pramudia Anantatur, who died a couple of years ago, actually said that there can be no change without real revolution, that Indonesia would actually have to experience real revolution in order to change, because the power of elites is so deeply rooted in Indonesian society that that without some strong movement, without some dramatic change in the country, there is no hope that there will be any positive progress. I personally think that Indonesia would probably need another 20 or 30 years to even realize what is happening there, because the brainwashing campaign during Suharto era was powerful. Indonesians were bombarded with nationalist slogans. They were taught to admire Western capitalist system. They were also forced to adopt one of five official religions. So you have a country where you have to believe in God. It's illegal to be an atheist. You have a country where you have to believe in market economics, because if you don't, you are defined as a communist, which is illegal, and their atheism and communism is considered a synonym. So you had to fit to several brackets, and there was no opposition allowed, and there was no alternative way of thinking permitted.
Well, of course, now Noam Chomsky is one of the few Americans who's written about Indonesia, the history, and its current political situation. And you have an association with Chomsky for the book you're working on now. Can you outline a little bit of how you came to travel in the same orbit as the great professor?
Well, actually, Noam and I we are still working on the book about the U.S. involvement in Indonesia. We didn't get so far. We have several chapters written, hopefully the work will progress faster soon. And Noam and I were corresponding for many years, and then we met first time in New York several years ago when I was opening my documentary film about Indonesia, Terlena, Breaking of the Nation, and Noam was speaking at Columbia University at the time. So to make a long story short, he's a person whom I admire probably the most of contemporary thinkers, and I wouldn't say that he's my mentor, but I would like to think that he is.
Now, what about your film? Now, you mentioned Terlena. I pronounced it wrong off the top, but Terlena, Breaking of a Nation. Now, you've been marketing this film, trying to get a broader audience for it, and it's difficult as an independent filmmaker, I know. How can our listeners here in Victoria, can they locate this film? Is it available online or in any other form?
Yes, they can access Mila Che Production. It's www.milache.org. And this film was actually produced with two camera people from Finnish National Television. And what is really remarkable about the film is that it's probably the first complete 90 minutes long documentary film about the killing fields in Suharto's Indonesia. We got hold of some historic footage, but we also worked with the great intellectuals in Indonesia who survived massacres of 1965, including Pramudia Anantatur, including Joko Pekik, the greatest Indonesian painter. But we also worked with Abdurrahman Wahid, otherwise known as Gus Dur, who was one of the Indonesian presidents after Suharto stepped back, and he's progressive Muslim cleric. And basically what we did, we tried to rewrite the history, because official history in Indonesia says that there was a communist coup in 1965 and that the army reacted or overreacted, and that led to the killing of 2 to 3 million people. Now, our theory is that there was no communist coup, of course, that it was set up by the CIA, and now the classified materials that you can see at the State Department websites, they show exactly that. Actually, U.S. supplied Indonesian military with the list of people who have to be liquidated. And then what happened, Indonesian military just went overboard.
Oh, was this a case similar to Chile, where Sukarno, Suharto's predecessor, refused to play ball with the Americans, and so they just sort of bumped
him
off?
Exactly. It was exactly the same scenario. In fact, I lived in Chile. I lived 7 years in Chile, and old people who still remember what happened in 1973 in Chile said that they were intimidated by the right wing, and they were saying, look, watch out. If you don't watch out, if you don't watch out, Jakarta is coming. So they were actually, it was very similar ball game, and it was actually Jakarta was using as a scarecrow to warn Chilean left.
You have 30 seconds
For them in case that they continue with their line.
Well, Andre, I've just heard the electronic voice tell me we've only got 30 seconds left, and I'm so sorry that I didn't have more phone card cachet here. But quickly, Asiana Press Agency, are you back up and running yet? I know you had some technical problems.
It's going to be relaunched on July 1st, and it's going to be relaunched under with the absolutely new website. Backed by a corn.
Goodbye.
Well, sadly, goodbye to Andre. Sorry about that, Andre. We got cut off there. It costs a lot of money to call Samoa. I had a full card there. But again, Andre's. If you want to see Andre's film, Terlena, Breaking of a Nation, this is the documentary chronicling the overthrow of Indonesia. He recommends www.milace, that's MILACHE.ORG, and you can find out more about that there. Again, that's Andre Velcek from 2008. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to a special tribute episode for Andre Velcek, the extraordinary justice activist, author, playwright, journalist, and filmmaker. Andre died September 22nd in Istanbul. Early reports emphasized investigation into his untimely death, but his wife assures Andre's death, though coming much too soon, was from natural causes. Years passed between my conversations with Andre. I reached him next in 2014 from his base in Indonesia. He had just returned from reporting in Ukraine. The Kiev coup was still fresh then, and the cities of what became known as Eastern Ukraine were being shelled by the Western-backed Maidan coasters. I wrote then, quote, though we're hearing little of last week's casus belli for a greater war in Ukraine, the brutal shelling of the cities of Eastern Ukraine continues. More than 2,000 are believed killed so far, while hundreds of thousands have been displaced by the fighting, and there seems no end in sight. Andre was filing reports from Ukraine last month, leaving the embattled country literally mere moments before the ill-fated MH17 was brought down. Now, Andrei was a native Russian. He emigrated to the United States in his 20s. We talked about his trip in the eastern part of Ukraine, the false narratives of the Western press, and about the war and the downing of the Malaysian jetliner MH17. Andre Velcek presently resides and works in East Asia and Africa, but it's in East Asia where we've caught up with him today, in Indonesia. In fact, welcome back to the program, Andre.
And Chris, it was very nice to talk to you again.
Well, it's my great pleasure, of course. Now, Andre, you were in Ukraine recently. You wrote an extensive piece about the situation there. And maybe you can tell us a little bit now. I mean, the media reports we were getting, though they seem to have dried up quite a bit, painted a picture of evil Putin and the good people of Kiev just defending themselves by bombing the east of their own country. But it's not quite that way. What are your impressions of Ukraine after your trip there?
Chris, I spent a couple of weeks basically traveling with my friends all around Ukraine. We drove 2,000 kilometers from Kiev down south to Odessa to the Transnistria border. Then we drove to Kharkov in eastern Ukraine, stopping on the way at the villages and industrial heartland around Kryvyi Rog, and then back to Kiev. We also went to the Russian border to check on the claims of the West that there are Russian troops amassed there. We didn't see any Russian troops when we were there. Actually, we saw several Ukrainian armed vehicles, and most of the stories that we heard from the Western media were absolutely wrong. And we talked to the local people, even in the villages, even in the central Ukraine, and people were indignant by the coup. They were very much against. They saw through the, what was happening in Kiev, and most of the people were against the situation. And now we didn't go to western Ukraine. We didn't go to Lviv and other cities. But it is, I guess, important to point out that the majority of Ukrainian people are living in the east and central Ukraine. So from Kiev, east and south, very few, very small percentage of the population lives in the west.
So the airliner, your article that was published in at counterpunch.org, I mean, I guess just one of the places, is called MH17 Sacrificed Airliner. What do you mean by sacrificed?
Well, it is very complicated. It's the title is, of course, very provocative. But what I was trying to say is that there was absolutely no proof, and there is absolutely no proof until now, that the airliner was shut down by the Russian or pro-Russian forces. In fact, I was communicating a lot with the with my contacts on the ground in Ukraine, but also in Europe, in Holland, and many people who were doing investigation. Also, I was studying very closely Russian sources, Russian military sources, which were providing the world with the radar imagery and analysis. All this leads clearly to the conclusion that the airliner was either shut down by the Ukrainian ground to air missile or by the Ukrainian military jet fighter. And that was there were analysis from the not only from the Russian military but also every that released by dissident, Western personnel that was operating at the time at the on the Ukrainian territory, including the air dispatcher, the Spanish air dispatcher, who was at the time working for the Ukrainian air control, and who went public about what he experienced. Yes, of the airplane, military airplanes, and the plane.
Sorry, Andre, you were breaking up just there, and I think you're talking about a very important point. The point being that there was an air traffic controller who, on the radar, saw that that there was a second plane when MH17 or shortly before MH17 was shot down or crashed. At least we're not sure exactly, but a second plane had the signature of a military plane shadowing the MH17. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, and I'm talking about the Sukhoi jet fighter that most likely belonged to the Ukrainian Air Force. And the Russian military command, Air Force command, was releasing all the imagery, all the data about the appearance of that airplane on the scene. Also, there was a lot of speculations, a lot of information about the course, about the change of the course of the airliner. He was forced to go off its usual track, off its usual course on the route from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur, and he had to change both altitude and its course. So there are many things that should have been addressed at least by the Western media and analyzed, but there were no analysis. It was just screaming and shouting that Russia was involved, that air to ground to air missiles were supplied by Russians to the Ukrainian rebels in the eastern Ukraine. All these unproven statements were actually passed as the facts, even by the outlets, media outlets like the BBC, which was absolutely scandalous. There was no proof. It was just basically Western media repeating the propaganda that was sent to them from the State Department and from the foreign ministries in Western Europe.
And it's a very important point, because this looked like, a month ago, it looked like this could be the trigger to a broader war and perhaps a war involving superpower America and Russia.
Yes, but what is happening, it's good to see all this in broader context. I just published a book which is called Fighting Against Western Imperialism, and it is about the West manufacturing oppositions all over the world, but also in the countries which it wants to get off the way from its imperialist designs. And this is actually, the situation is accelerating. It's not only Ukraine, it's not only Russia, it is also China, what we see here in Asia. When I went to Philippines, for instance, to talk to top academia from the National University of Philippines, and I was told that the West, particularly the United States, is pitching now Philippines and other Southeast Asian countries against China. We see the same thing in Japan, the old imperialist country, which is now an ally of the United States, openly provoking China. We see new developments in Latin America where the opposition is being manufactured, even in the countries like Brazil. Forget about Venezuela, of course, in Venezuela, in Bolivia, and in other places. But so there is this huge drive now to create or to destroy the governments, to destroy the countries that are standing on the way to the geopolitical ambitions of the West to basically control the entire planet.
Well, that's interesting, given, I mean, we've seen for at least 8 years now, there's been a constant drumbeat against Iran, a country that fits the description, fits your description of standing in the way of Western imperialism, or at least being a thorn in the side of them. But in recent days, we've seen Iran and the United States kind of cozy up together, especially vis-a-vis natural gas routes that the Russians had hoped to get going that would bypass the Ukraine. But now the Iranians are what has been described as a stab in the back of Russia, agreeing to supply gas to Europe themselves.
Yes, well, Iran is most likely taking a detour in its position when it was standing against the West for years. So Iran is, of course, exhausted, so financially and otherwise. So it is possible, although I don't think this situation is going to last for a long time, because Iran is still part of this big opposition had been formed against the Western domination of the world. And of course that opposition includes most of the countries of BRICS except India. And so it is almost entire Latin America, Russia, China, some African countries, and above mentioned Iran. So I think this is just a temporary situation.
Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria, cfuv.uvic.ca on the internet, everywhere else. I'm speaking tonight with Andrei Velcek. Andrei is a novelist and filmmaker. He is currently making documentaries for TV Telesur, Latin America's biggest broadcaster, and for Press TV, speaking of Iran, Iran's state broadcaster. Andrei's novels include Nalazeni and Point of No Return, and in nonfiction titles, Western Terror, From Potosi to Baghdad, Indonesia, Archipelago of Fear, Oceania, and that's published by Expathos, our good friend Rich Castelline over there in Holland. And it's the result of 5 years of his work in Micronesia, Polynesia, and Melanesia, and with Rossi Indira, Exile, a book of conversations with foremost Southeast Asian writer Pramodya Anantatur. I'm sorry about that, Pramodya. I ruined that, I'm sure. And his latest book, as you mentioned, is Fighting Western Imperialism. Well, Andrei, I mean, if this is right, then that the current imbroglio in Ukraine is all really about Western imperial ambition and picking fights with, I guess, foremost Russia and China, are they just going to keep on going and find another excuse in some other country just and knock these things over domino-like until they get the war that they want?
Alliance being formed now. You notice that the meetings in Brazil between Russia and China and Latin America left many signed contracts and many signed agreements between these countries. For instance, Russia forgave $336 billion U.S. dollars in debt to Cuba. China came very close to Brazil, to Venezuela, and other countries. So BRICS are becoming, South Africa was present, so BRICS are becoming very outspoken and very strong. So these parts of the world are moving closer together. It's not going to be very easy to overrun these countries. They are powerful. There is about 40% of the world population living in BRICS. So we are all now looking at India. Where is India going to, what stand is India going to take? I just came back from India. I was there for 2 weeks. It doesn't look too good. It seems that the President Modi's government is being very close to Washington, but still there are forces that are very critical of the West, even in India. But even without India, Latin America, Russia, China, and South Africa, and above mentioned Iran, are a very strong opposition that we have to counter with. Also, there is a new media. These countries are, it's not only military opposition, it's not only philosophical opposition. There is a huge media, new media that is standing against the Western propaganda. You have above mentioned Telesur, for which I'm making films. Telesur is the biggest, basically, television station in South America. It's broadcasting from Caracas, Venezuela. There is RT, of course, in Moscow, very powerful media which is broadcasting all over the world, and it's both television and also it's written reports in form of blogs. Of course, Press TV in Iran and CCTV in China, which is becoming also more vocal, is putting its act together. So there is a new media which is beaming counter-propaganda back towards the population in the West, and which is trying to create, maintain the opposition voice.
You've written an article published up at counterpunch.org saying don't dilute the BRICS. What do you mean by that, Andrei?
Well, there is a very dangerous possibility that the countries which are essentially, extra right, extremely right wing or almost fascist, like Indonesia, may want to join BRICS. So there is this group of countries which is called MINT. MINT includes Mexico, Indonesia, Nigeria, and these countries are actually, particularly Indonesia, which was a model to fascist states since the coup in 1965, which was orchestrated by the United States, and in which between 2 and 3 million people were murdered. These countries are, you know, you can call them turbo capitalists, and they are until now they're claiming to be democratic, but they really are not. It's Indonesia is definitely not democratic, and although it has elections, then you have countries like Turkey, which is an enormous ally of the West. There are it's a NATO country actually, and it has enormous military bases, air force bases all over the country, particularly in the east. This is where Israeli pilots are being trained, for instance, at the outskirts of the city of Konya. This is where the Syrian camps, so-called refugee camps, but actually camps which are training the Syrian opposition fighters, were located already for years. So, you know, Mexico is relatively benign. But then you have a country like Nigeria, which is, according to all my friends and analysts in Africa, is definitely a country which is destroying its, which has spied for its own majority of its own population. So these countries, if they enter BRICS, you know, they will dilute, they will totally dilute this group. And they will move it towards capitalism, they will move it towards the right, they will move it towards the West, and there will not be any more this determined group of countries standing on the way to the domination of the West by United States and Europe. And even now there is India, of course, but India is the only one. So imagine if you have another 3 or 4 countries of that which are moving in a totally opposite direction from Brazil and from Russia and from China and from South Africa.
Well, it sounds to me, and I'm sorry I haven't read your book, Fighting Western Imperialism, yet, but it sounds to me that you're anxious that there be a reintroduction of a bipolar world to keep the American or Anglo-American empire in check.
Well, I hope there is... actually, because this is the only way. We need opposition. We need the diversity of Slovo. I mean, after the Soviet Union was destroyed, and we had only we had one polar world, and it looked very ugly. It was really a dictatorship. So now what we are having is alternative economic and social systems. I'm not saying that all of them are great. I mean, countries are making mistakes. Russia, for example, is not necessarily a socialist country anymore, but it's definitely not a fascist country as it was under Yeltsin. I mean, you have to understand that what Yeltsin introduced to Russia was, again, some kind of a watered-down Indonesian model of 65, and it's not very different again than what the Arseniy Yatsenyuk in Ukraine is now trying to introduce in that part of the world. So yes, Russia is not perfect, China is not perfect, but China lifted up hundreds of millions of people out of poverty, and it seems that the state of China is serving its citizens, again, in not in perfect way, but in a much better way than anything that we see in the U.S. or Western colonies. And then, of course, Latin America, which is pushing their own socialist agenda. So the world suddenly has, again, alternatives, and it's definitely what the West doesn't want to see, because they want everybody to be in line and everybody to be quiet and just serve the corporate interests of Europe and the United States.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to a Guerrilla Radio special tribute program dedicated to the recently deceased journalist and humanitarian Andrei Velchek. Friend and colleague Ramin Mazahiri of Press TV said of Andrei, quote, "I can't say much about Andrei without resorting to something like repetitive awe. He was astoundingly productive. His bravery in the subjects he dared to cover was consistently astounding, and his analyses and style were equally astounding for their clarity and humanity. I don't think he had a peer, frankly. Well, it's a sentiment with which I entirely concur. It's difficult to talk about Andre's work, both its immense profusion and the harrowing nature of it that leaves one awestruck, not only because he went into the heart of some of the darkest, most dangerous conflicts in the world, but that he also lived for extended periods in the same desperately poor conditions and suffering the privations, to a lesser degree, he would insist, of the people he reported on. We spoke in 2015 about his then recently released book, Exposing the Lies of Empire and the Ruthless Nature of Western Capitalism. Andre was in Beirut reporting on the Syrian refugee crisis in Lebanon and Saudi Arabia's bombing campaign against Yemen, then just begun.
Well, welcome back to the program, Andre. It's good to hear you. Now, Andre, you're in Beirut tonight. Can you tell me what is the sentiment in Lebanon, regarding Syria and Saudi Arabia's attack against the Houthi majority in Yemen, as we saw last week?
Well, Chris, the situation here in Lebanon is very complicated. As you probably know, Lebanon is hosting officially 1.3 million Syrian refugees, but unofficially they are talking about 2 million Syrians living in this very small country. There was a winter, very harsh winter in Lebanon, especially in Bekaa Valley, and some people were in a very tragic, very difficult situation. There were reports of some refugees freezing to death. The Lebanese government is strained. There is no money to accommodate to comfortably refugees. They are spread all around the area. They live in people's houses. Those who have money are renting apartments. There are no refugee camps. So the situation is very difficult. Lebanon is, again, there are no official statistics lately, but it's one-third of the population is supposed to be Christian, one-third is Shia Muslim, and one-third is Sunni Muslim. So when it comes to the reaction of Lebanese public towards the situation in Yemen, involvement of Saudi Arabia, of brutal bombing of Yemen, rule of thumb is that Shia minority, or one-third of the population that is Shia, is of course strongly opposing this. Hezbollah, which is based here in Lebanon, is opposing it. And other parts of the population tend to be more quiet about it, or one would say supportive.
And what about the new player, or at least the overtly new player, Saudi Arabia? I know that they are no friends of Hezbollah or Iran, Lebanon's sponsor, for that matter. What does this mean, the bombing campaign that Saudi Arabia kicked off in Yemen? What does it mean for the Lebanese?
Bombing campaign of Yemen, of course, is very detrimental impact on the entire region, especially because many countries here that are close allies of the West, of the United States, are threatening or promising to join the campaign, and particularly is Turkey and Egypt. Egypt had a military coup just 1 year and a half ago. We don't like to call it military coup, but it was military coup in which several thousand people were murdered. So the military is back to power, pro-Western military is back to power in Egypt, and it is basically saying that it is going to join the campaign against Yemen. In some Sunni countries like Egypt, for instance, Shia Shia Muslims or Shia teaching is totally forbidden. It just doesn't exist. It's illegal. So what we see right now, the escalation, the bombing, again, is to basically the ally of the West, so one of the biggest, most powerful allies of the West, Saudi Arabia, is once again flexing its muscle, and it is
it is on the offensive against the part of Islam which it considers illegal, which is again Shia.
You've written, and again, your latest book, Exposing Lies of the Empire, you write about the enormous refugee, among other things, the enormous refugee problem created by these wars. In December of last year, the United Nations released a study that there was almost 14 million people displaced in Iraq and Syria alone. Well, what are the effects of all these masses of refugees on the region you're in Lebanon right now, but in the region as a whole?
The region, the refugees are all around. We are talking about internally displaced people. We are talking about external refugees. Syrian refugees are living in organized camps in Jordan and in Turkey. They are living in Lebanon in very disorganized manner. They also even live in Iraq. But then again, Iraqi people are being displaced. We are talking about millions of people on the move. It's a very depressing situation. The West, of course, took full advantage of the refugee crisis, particularly in Turkey and in Jordan, and it began arming the Syrian, so-called Syrian opposition against Assad in these camps. The biggest camps are near the city of Hatay, and but also on the border of between Syria and Jordan on the Jordanian side. So this is where the ISIS or Islamic State were created, and they were. There are reports that the fighters from ISIS were trained, they were financed, and they were encouraged to fight by the NATO in these camps. And I was investigating this when I was making documentary films. A documentary film for Venezuelan television channel Telesur, so 2 years ago already. So then I investigated in Jordan. So it is very clear that there are, and it is also even admitted by the Middle Eastern press, by some outlets, that the fighters are openly trained in these refugee camps. So this is one thing. The other thing is that refugees, millions of them actually, had to leave their countries because of the Western attacks or the Western encouragement of the opposition. But once they become refugees, their fate is very dire. It's very depressing. There is very little interest in helping them on the large scale. Lately, not long ago, there was a pledge now coming from the West and from the Gulf countries of about $3.8 billion to finally deal with the Syrian refugee crisis. But even this amount of money is not going to be sufficient. I was driving through Bekaa Valley recently. I was talking to refugees, and many children don't go to schools. Many people cannot get any medical care. They cannot even beg because they are here illegally. And when they go to the, there were allegations that I heard that even the United Nations turns away people who want to get registered. And without registration, of course, they cannot do anything. They cannot get food cards. They cannot get drinking water. They cannot get children to the schools. Nothing. So it is a very cynical situation. The West destabilized this entire part of the world, and then it does not deal sufficiently with the refugees that are coming from Syria and from other countries, particularly Iraq, because of this crisis. Iraq is another story. Just 3 months ago, I was only 6 kilometers from the city of Mosul, and I got there from Erbil, from the Kurdish Iraqi, from Iraqi Kurdistan, as they call it. Again, it was a very depressing situation there because all the commanders that I met, the Kurdish Iraqi commanders, were trained in the United Kingdom or in the United States. they were openly saying it. They showed me the villages that were destroyed by the first by ISIS and then by the U.S. bombing. So the situation was extremely depressing.
Well, Andre, as I mentioned, you're in Beirut tonight. Well, tonight your time, anyway. And I should mention too that Andre's website is Andre Velchek. That's VLTCHEK.weebly.com. AndreVelchek.weebly.com. Where do you plan to be next, Andre?
I'm going in 1 week to India, and I'm showing two of my films there, and I'm speaking at Nehru University and Delhi University. Basically, 2 weeks, 2 months ago, I was in India investigating the genocide that India is committing in Kashmir. And it's one of these untold stories. It's a horrific thing. It's as terrible as what Indonesia is doing in Papua. So I'm trying to put together these genocides that the client states are, you know, performing with absolute complacency and support from the West, because both U.S. and Israel are actually involved in Kashmir. They have advisors there, they have a staff, they have joined exercises, and you know, there is at least 100,000 people dead, and terrible things. So I'm going back to India, at least trying to do something. I'm meeting Arundhati Roy again, Sanjay Kak, great Indian filmmaker. So we'll be organizing some talks at two major universities in Delhi, and also showing of my films from the Congo genocide. So it's kind of exchanging notes and trying to do something about the terrible situation.
Well, Andre, your intrepidness are humbling indeed. I highly recommend people go to Andre's site, Andre Velchek, VLTCHEK. You can see his writings at Counterpunch or at guerrillaradioblog.blogspot.com. Thanks a lot, Andre, for coming on the program again, eh?
Chris, it's always a joy to be on your show. I hope to be back soon.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio's special tribute program dedicated to recently deceased journalist and humanitarian Andre Velchek. As Andre revealed in his books, films, articles, and interviews, the rarely uttered fact is we in the West are not a benevolent, progressive, democratic force for good in the world, but are instead an avaricious empire practicing a ruthless form of capitalist fundamentalism that is both battering the poorest of humanity while destroying the planet's ecology. I last spoke to Andre in February of this year, 2020. He was working on his latest film from his base in Hong Kong, and we talked about his beloved Borneo and the Indonesian government's planned relocation of the capital city of Jakarta to that island, a move Andre feared spelled the end of both the indigenous culture and ecology there. And you dream away your nightmares so you can survive. Welcome back to the program, Andre.
Chris, hi. It's great to be back.
Well, Andre, you're freshly back from Borneo. What did you find there this latest trip?
Well, first of all, I found a parasite which attacked my eye. I'm now in Hong Kong trying to get rid of horrible infections all over my body, eyes, stomach, and everything. The situation there is terrible. My ordeal is nothing compared to the millions of people, particularly the native people, so-called Dayak, who lived there for centuries, created great civilizations, and were basically robbed of everything, first by Dutch and then by the Japanese colonialism, which was actually shaped on the terrible examples of Western colonialism all over the world. Island of Borneo is the third biggest island in the world after Greenland and Papua. And it is divided between Indonesia, where it's called Kalimantan, Malaysia, and Brunei Darussalam.
Now, what is happening in the Indonesian part of the island is absolute despicable, and it is not only crime against humanity, but it is also crime against the nature. Entire island was plundered of its riches, and riches that are great, from beautiful and mighty river like Kapuas, to raw materials of all sorts, from coal to uranium, gold, and other things, which were consistently robbed by the elites of Indonesia, mainly from Java, and by the Western multinational companies. Dayak people, the native people, were especially after 1965 coup backed by the United States and the West, they were pushed further and further into the interior, and their wonderful socialist culture, which was actually socialist long before Karl Marx was born, was reduced to absolutely small areas deep, deep in the center of the island. As you know, dictator Suharto was absolutely horrified by anything left of center, and he declared Dayaks basically communists, and he was destroying their long houses, their way of life, their entire culture, while plundering all that he could get his hands on. And now this new administration of Joko Widodo, called Jokowi, in Indonesia, is doing precisely the same things as Suharto was doing before. So absolute plunder and horror, which I witnessed, as you mentioned, for 2.5 years, as I'm coming consistently to the island, making a documentary film, writing a book together with a local academic from Pontianak, and just basically trying to document in any ways the ordeal, which is surprisingly, or not surprisingly, actually avoiding the spotlight of the mass media all over the world.
Andre, as bad as Suharto was to Borneo while he was in power, he never did something as audacious as moving the entire capital there. One of the planning minister of the current government, he says, and I'll quote him, he says, this move to Borneo of the capital will, quote, not disturb any existing protected forest. Instead, we will rehabilitate it. How optimistic are you, Andre, that the move can be benign, if not even helpful, to the environment of Borneo?
It is absolutely impossible that it would be benign, given the history, given the track record of a modern Indonesia. Let's be precise, actually. The capital, the plan to move capital to Borneo, existed already under the socialist president, Ahmed Sukarno, but it was totally different. Actually, he began planning the capital, but building it, actually. But it was totally different type of the capital. It was growing in the city of Palangkaraya, and it was built by the Soviet Union. And they were planning, actually, a normal, very developed socialist city in Borneo, with theaters, with the libraries, with huge public areas, with metro system. And Sukarno was building it as a bulwark, as a protection against the British imperialism and against Malaysia, which was seen at the time as a player that was supporting Western imperialism. Then in 1965, after the coup by Suharto, all these projects were stopped and people arrested. And Palangkaraya today is big but scarcely populated, depressing city. It was one of the three candidates for the new capital. The new plan is absolutely different story. I mean, we have a turbo capitalist system. They have the system which ruined all the cities, basically, and all the islands of Indonesia. And it is a so-called, project of with for all private sector participation. So there are already you know, divided enormous areas of land designated for the capital. And it is absolutely different time, and it is in the history, and this is totally different type of project. Now, the reason they decided to do it mainly, and I wrote a lot about this, is that Jakarta, the capital, current capital of Indonesia, is so-called sinking. It is overpopulated. It is a horrible city with all sorts of social problems. And according to my calculations, with more than half of the population living in absolute misery in so-called kampungs, which are basically slums, surrounding five-star malls and five-star hotels, which are money laundering ventures of the rich. So they understood that they cannot save Jakarta anymore because they overpopulated it. They made it unlivable. The infrastructure, particularly sanitation, drainage system, garbage recycling, is non-existent or it's in the absolutely horrific shape, and nobody wants to invest in anything public. So in Indonesia, everything is only pro-profit. So they decided on a very cynical move, a very immoral move, which I'm told by a few, at least, architects who have some conscience. So, and they decided to move the capital, escape from the capital, and let Jakarta basically, sink. So in 2030, according to many studies, a big part of the capital will be underwater. Some talk about 25%, some talk about 30%. But you know that the city and the area of this magnitude, if you sink 20 or 25%, the city becomes unlivable, uninhabitable. So they know it, and they waited until the end, and now they are going to use golden parachute, use public money, let the private sector get fatter than it is, and participate in this. And the rich families, the elites, and the government, they have their own houses already in California, in Australia. They have their apartments in Hong Kong and Singapore. So they don't care.
Well, Andre, I've said it before. Your work amazes me, and just the scope and breadth of your travels is something to behold just in itself. Not to mention all the fabulous work you do. You can see Andre's work, at least some of it, at his own website, andrevelchek.weebly.com. That's Andre A-N-D-R-E Velchek. VLTCHEK.weebly.com. AndreVelchek.weebly.com. I do a search, go to the New Eastern Outlook to NEO to see some of his writings, or at 21st Century Wire. But at his own site, you can get links to his films and his fiction writing and nonfiction books and everything else. Andre, I really hope that you get well and you treat successfully this bug that you picked up in your last trip to Borneo.
Thank you so much, Chris.
All right, then. I look forward to to our next conversation, Andre. Thanks a lot for talking to me tonight, eh?
Definitely. Anytime, Chris. Great always to be on your radio show. It's fantastic. Thank you so much.
All right, then. I'll talk to you again.
Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Officially, you never get to know it, but organically you try to rise above it. You see rainbows up above that don't exist, but you know that there is something up there in the mist. You see clouds making faces you know in the sky. You upgrade to a blinded artificial eye. There is pain in your love life causing you to scream, but there's light in your mind's eye, so each day you breathe. Dream of something better than the things you do, and you dream of something better for your children too. Yes, you dream because your dreams are keeping you alive, and you dream away your nightmares so you can survive.